Listener-supported Light of Life Radio brings you Answering the Call, discussing the spiritual journeys of priests, deacons, and religious in our listening area. And now here's Answering the Call with host Irene Carubia.
We thank all our listeners for joining us today on Answering the Call, brought to you by LOL Radio, broadcasting throughout North Central West Virginia and the Upper Ohio Valley. It is here that we discuss with priests and religious from our listening area their call from God for their vocation. I'm Irene Carubia, and today we have with us Father Jim O'Connor, pastor of St. Augustine in Grafton, West Virginia, and St. Elizabeth in Philippi, West Virginia. Welcome, Father Jim. Let us begin by telling our listening audience about the early influences in your life.
Well, thank you very much, Irene, and it's good to be here. I am the youngest of three sons, born to Larry and Roxana O'Connor. Larry, my father, being from a very devout Irish Catholic family in Wellsburg, and my mother coming from a very religious, devout Methodist family in Elm Grove, Wheeling. My mother had three boys in 2.5 years, and I was born in 1950 as the youngest. My earliest recollection of my family and religion and faith really stemmed around the fact that my father would take us to church religiously, as you would, and I went to St. Vincent de Paul School, grade school in Elm Grove, and grew up as a Catholic schoolboy. The greatest influence in my earliest life, religion and in spiritual life, is my father's mother, Annie O'Connor, a very, very devout religious, Irish religious woman. We spent a lot of time at her house in Wellsburg. I attribute her as being the great spiritual influence in my life. I became an altar boy. I had a keen interest in Mass and all that we did in church and in the sacrament celebrations. Even though I could say I didn't understand it, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot, being an altar boy. So much so that when I was in the third or fourth grade, I took a shoebox and I created an altar with the claws, with the little mini book. And this is back in the day when the priest was the high altar and you only saw the stand on the right and the stand on the left and the priest's back. And there was the tabernacle, and I made a little child. I made all these little things out of cardboard, this, that, and the other. And I got pieces of cloth, and I made the corporal. And I did all these things. When I was done playing Mass, I put them in the shoebox, and I had my Mass kit there, my early Mass kit.
Your early Mass.
And when I was in the seventh grade, we moved away from Wheeling to Charleston. I ended up at St. Albans, at St. Francis of Assisi Grade School in St. Albans, and I continued to be an altar boy there for at least another year. My next spiritual experience, growth, I was interested in deep things, and I would contemplate the stars. I would contemplate the universe, and that's a very dangerous thing for a teenager to be doing. I mean, I remember being up at night and all the rest of the family being asleep, and I would be pondering the meaning of life, you know, at the age of 15 or 16. And a lot of it was, it was painful in the sense because I had so many questions and I wanted answers. And I always had this sense of being a part of something bigger. And I think that's one of the reasons I really enjoyed being an altar boy. And it was secure. I felt protected. Oh. My family was very, I hate to use that catchword of dysfunction and stuff, but we had our own dysfunctions as families might have. Our family was very insecure in many ways. My father was a traveling salesman, and my mother was a stay-at-home mother. But we had a lot of conflict going on all the time. It didn't always feel safe. Home was not always a place of feeling safe. And I think I really found in the church. In fact, I know I did. I found in the church a place that where I felt safe.
Right, a sense of security.
And not just the physical building at all, but with the nuns and with the liturgy, with all the stuff. I mean, at the time, I'm just a kid and just experiencing something. I couldn't tell you, what is this, what's going on with you, that type of thing. But there always was that connection. And I think that was a seed, and that was part of my vision that I didn't quite understand that was happening.
So did you ever think then about becoming a priest?
I think I only entertained the idea of becoming a priest in grade school. And once that was over, it was over. I knew that I was wounded. I was a wounded kid, psychologically, emotionally, and all these things. I knew there was a lot of wound there. And I just never felt like I would ever... I didn't even entertain it after a point, because it's like, really, you know, it's like, you are the last person that would be a good candidate because you're so wounded.
So you didn't think you were good enough?
Definitely not good enough. So I just let it go. Just let it go. Then I entered the Air Force after 1 year of college. I joined the Air Force for three reasons. One is to think about what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I needed time. I'd already gone 1 year of college at West Virginia State. Two, to get money to go to college. And three, to get away from home. And I accomplished all three. The problem was that my mother and father at that time, when I was 17, got divorced. So my mother was at home, had never been allowed to work outside of the home. Even though she had a lot of skills, she was alone. My brothers had grown up and moved out, and here I was, the last one. My Marine brother, the oldest, he was wounded in Vietnam, Purple Heart, so he had to recover at Walter Reed. And then my father lived in Florida, so from Walter Reed, he went to Florida to stay with my dad for a little while, because my dad had had a heart attack at 45. I couldn't leave my mother alone after all of this. But my brother decided to come back to Charleston, and he moved in with my mother. As soon as that happened, I said, I'm out of here. My mother's not alone.
You found the escape route.
I found the escape route. I decided that I wanted to do military service. I wanted to do something. At the time, it was really important, and I want my family to be proud of me. My oldest brother, the Marine, my other brother, who's a year and a half older than me, he joined the Air Force the year before that, before me, and became a mechanic. So I decided to join the Air Force. And as I say it, it's funny how it worked, because my brother, the Marine, just barely got out alive. And he looked at me, and he knew I was going down to the recruiter, and he said, Jim, just telling you this, I'm not threatening, I'm just telling you a fact, that if you think about joining the Marines or the Army, I will break both of your legs and both of your arms.
He said, saw it firsthand. He didn't want you to have to go through that.
Well, he didn't want me to die.
Yeah.
So I looked at him and I said, I wasn't thinking about Marines or the Army. I want to join the Air Force. I always wanted to fly, you know. And I like their uniforms. So I joined the Air Force. Well, irony would have it that in basic training, no matter what you got in for, that if you got a certain grade on language test, you were going to become a linguist. I did. And the language they gave me to learn was not just Vietnamese, but North Vietnamese. So I was thrust together with, most of these guys were already college graduates. And here I am, lowly guy. And so we learned North Vietnamese. 47 weeks, 5 days a week, 6 hours a day, nothing but the language. So by the time we were finished, we were proficient at it. And that was to set us up to become radio operators, recon missions over Vietnam and Laos. So, ironies of ironies.
So you went into the Air Force and you got stuck.
I joined the Air Force to not go to Vietnam. I ended up being a Vietnamese linguist. My older brother, not the oldest, who was the jet mechanic, he wondered why, when he finished his training, that everybody around him got sent to Vietnam, but he didn't. And he thanked me not too long ago. He said, "Thank you for, you're the reason I didn't go to Vietnam." I went, "What?" He said, "Oh yeah." He said, "Because they didn't want two brothers
in the same
arena." And I went, "I never do." He said, "Yeah." He said, "That's the reason I didn't go to Vietnam." A significant part of my life, 2 years of training just to get there, and then 2 years of being involved. First, reconning missions out of Okinawa.
So you signed up for 4 years, or that was
4 years? No, 4 years was the minimum.
Oh, that was the minimum. Okay.
That was like if you signed up, you had to sign up for 4 years. Then I ended up at a remote base on the Mekong River, but in Thailand, across from Laos, where we sat there and watched the war. Plus, we were the unit that didn't really exist.
Under the radar.
Literally under the radar. But now the significant part of my story, my spiritual journey, happens to be a certain person that I was thrown together with. His name is André Vigneault. So I call him a French Canadian from Maine. André, part of my unit, from day one, right out of basic training, that's when we met, and then we were thrust together for the whole time because our specialty was so specialized that as you're going through all these steps, everybody's going through the same steps, and there's a limited jobs that you're going to do, and your assignments, you end up being together, where that doesn't always happen in the military. André and I started talking about things that nobody else would even bother to talk about, and that was more to life, you know, more things, you know, like, you know, the mind and what is reality, and I mean, all these things you think about, you know, like, who goes around talking about this stuff, you know?
So you and André hit it off. You were probably the same type of spiritual person that he was.
I look back and I know that to be absolutely true because he was older. He was like most everybody was older, 4 or 5 years older, and he was one of them. His background is interesting because he studied with the Franciscans in minor seminary as a high schooler. Then he studied with them through college. So he is a part as a Franciscan student with them. But when he graduated from college, he decided it wasn't his calling. So he went on to teach French. That was his first language anyway. So he went on. But then he lost his exempt status because now you graduated from college and now you're 1A. And so that's how we came to be together. We would share books. I'd read a book. And I'd say, "Oh, here, André, I think you'd like that." And he'd do the same thing back and forth. So this went on for a while. So as we both ended up going over to Okinawa, flying missions and whatnot, and then we ended up going to Thailand together, you know, again, the same group. André one day came to me, this is 1972, said, "You know, Jim, I was reading this book." Like I said, we exchanged books. He said, "I think you might be interested in this." And the name of the book was Pentecostal Movement in the Catholic Church by Father Edward O'Connor. My name is James Edward O'Connor.
It's more than a coincidence.
Yeah, I know. So I read it, and then André and I start talking about it. "Wow, things really have changed since we left the United States." I mean, that was my first reaction. Was like, you know, we've been gone, but wow, things really have changed. Not realizing that about the whole movement started Duquesne and whatnot. So André and I both agreed that we should look into this when we get back to the world, when we got back to our life. Because we were always talking on us spiritual realities and stuff. We were really into talking about those kind of things. We both get out in March of 1973. Now, we were both a part of the end of the war, but we were part of it in a way that most people weren't. In November and December of 1972, we sent every single bomber that was stationed in Thailand, B-52s, and went and blanketed North Vietnam with bombs. And that's what brought them to the peace table. We were the closest unit site to Hanoi. Because we, even though we were in a neutral country, we were the narrowness of Laos, narrowed right there, and right across these mountains on the other side was Hanoi. We were the base that if you could get back over those mountains, get back to, you know, across the Mekong River, then you were safe. And some of them didn't, and they were blowing up in our midst. We were watching them blow up. And this and the other. So it was very significant. And that's kind of an emotional moment there. I think I was always a searcher in high school and whatnot. I was always a seeker. I was always seeking something more. And when I was at that remote base, it was very depressing. It was very depressing. Because once people start killing each other, nothing makes sense. Nothing. And I felt that deeply because I was always that sensitive person. And I remember writing a letter to my dad and just telling him how bad I felt. And he wrote me back and said, you know, Jim, I stay up at night. He was in World War II. He said, I stay up at night, 2-3 o'clock in the morning. He said, I felt that way too many times. He affirmed me in a way that he had not affirmed me before. Like, you're okay. You're my son. I had some physical ailment. You know, you can pick up anything over there as far as gastrointestinal. And all that. So I was down at a base having some tests done. And I was hanging out at the non-commissioned officers club. And that's, if you're a sergeant, you get to go to there. So, and there was some guy start talking about these things. And he started talking about, because I was talking about spiritual stuff, this, that, and the other. And he said, you know, why don't we go to my hooch? So we go over there. So he's now trying to convert me. He's trying to get me to surrender my life to the Lord Jesus and make Jesus my Savior, my personal Lord and Savior. And I listened to him, and I listened to him, and I listened to him, and I listened. I said, I know you're trying to get me. You want to get me to get my, I'm at knees. You want me to do this. I'm sorry, but I can't do that. I said, I'm not going to do that. So then Andre brings this book. I mean, these things are like, coincidence? I don't think so. So he brings this book about the Pentecostal movement. So we get out of the Air Force in March of 73. He goes back to Maine his way, and I come back to West Virginia. And I've already been accepted at WVU, but that doesn't start until the fall. So I've got March to September or August. So we made an agreement that we would get together that last hurrah before we go on with the rest of our life. And I was going to go to college, and I forget what he was planning on doing at the time. I drive up there in August of 1973, and we had a mutual friend. Again, these guys were together all the time. That lived in northern Maine. So he was at Caribou, Maine. Andre's from Biddeford, Maine. Those are the total north-south ends of Maine. Andre and I decide we'll go up to Baxter State Park up near Bangor, which Millinocket, and our friend would come down and meet us there, and we would climb Mount Katahdin, which is the first place that the sun reaches United States when it rises. Mount Katahdin is the northernmost end of the Appalachian Trail. So we meet him and whatnot, and he guides us up to, there's all kinds of different ways you can go it. And so he gets above the tree line, and Jeff is his name. Jeff says, okay, this is as far as I go. And Andre and I look at each other like, Jeff, you've done this before. We haven't. He said, you just keep walking up there. He said, I'm not going to do it because I've already done it. He said, and I'm not doing it again. And so we did that. So that was our big experience. The day before I was to leave everything there and come back to West Virginia and get ready to go to school, we went to a movie that seemed pretty interesting because I like music. I had played the piano since I was seven and enjoyed just losing myself in music. At the USO on base in Thailand, that's what I spent hours and hours and hours. It was the way I got through my depression. I would just sit down at a piano and I would start playing because I memorized everything. So we went to see this movie that seemed very intriguing. It's called Jesus Christ Superstar. It was like, to me, music in my life always was expressive of who I was. It really, I emote my feelings. It got my feelings out through music. And it wasn't even the words, it was just the music. So when we left that theater that night, I had the car. I think if I'd understood it, I might have been baptized in the Spirit there. But I didn't understand that. All I understood was, and I'm sitting in the car, we get in the car, and it's kind of cold that night. I started crying. Now, I think it was everything coming together. Okay, you've lived this much of your life. You spent these 4 years in intensive experience there with these people. Now you're about to go on to the rest of your life, and you have no idea what that's going to be, but you're leaving everything you've known behind. You know, you're leaving these people. You'll probably never see them again. I start crying. He said, "What's the matter?" I said, I can't explain it, Andre. I said, something about Jesus in that movie. It's that one song. He's climbing up the mountain, doing everything you've asked me to do. It's that crucial song that he sings before he surrenders to the crucifixion. I've never seen Jesus portrayed in an emotional way in my whole life. Never. The only person that I really, really experienced having emotions when it came to faith was my saintly grandmother. She cried all the time with her faith. It just tore me apart. And I said to Andre, the only way I can explain how I feel, this must be what a person feels who has walked away from their vocation of being a priest. This must be what a priest feels like who walked away from his vocation. And I did not mean that one iota. In my mind, I think I should be a priest. It was putting religion and my emotions together, saying my faith and my emotions together, saying, this must be what it feels like to be that priest. Say, let's try to put this in an image that would make sense. And that was it. So we part company, and I come back to college. I went to the Newman Center at St. John's and to talk to the priest there who was in charge, Father Ed Hoffler, a Paulist. My main problem was that school was easier than I thought it was going to be, and I had all this time on my hands. I didn't know what to do with my time. I needed to do something. And so I went to him to see if he could say, you know, well, you can help us do this or you could help do that. The whole conversation I had with him ended up not being that. It ended up being about my faith. And I cried, not literally cried, but I was crying on his shoulder about how I just feel like I should have more faith. I just feel like I want more faith. In the conversation and everything, I said, my family, good Christian people, good faithful, but we didn't talk about faith. We just never talked about it. And he said something. He said, well, maybe you're going to be the one to change that. I felt frustrated because I said to him, did you not hear anything I've been saying? I don't have that faith. He said, well, maybe you will be the one. He invited me to come and come to daily mass. So he said, well, we meet in the library at 3 o'clock and you can meet other students. And so I did. Well, the first time that I went, just before then, maybe even that morning, I got a letter from Andre. And in the letter, he said, you know, that book we were reading, that Pentecostal movement in the Catholic Church, he said, I really decided to investigate that. And I found this priest in Portland. He and I are going to start a prayer meeting. And we did. And last week was our first prayer meeting. We had all these people we wanted to pray for, and you were one of them. So I show up at 3 o'clock Mass at the Newman Center. And there was one particular student. His name was Fred Gruey. He was from Wheeling, Elm Grove. So it was like, oh, I got somebody from where I grew up. I said, you know, do you ever heard about this thing, what was a Pentecostal movement in the Catholic? You ever heard anything like that? And he said, oh, yeah, we have prayer meetings every Tuesday night out at the Friary. And I didn't know what the Friary was. And I said, really? He said, yeah, tonight. It was a Tuesday. I said, oh. He said, 7 o'clock. I said, oh, okay. And he started telling me how to get there. And he said, I'm not going to be there. He said, I can't make it tonight. And I'm thinking, oh, I met this person. I got a connection. I know somebody. So I made sure that I was fashionably late to that prayer meeting that night. I drove out, and I showed up, I think, probably at 20 after 7. Because I didn't want to show up and have to meet these people or get into any conversations about things. I just, let me go and let me just see what it's all about. So I walk in and everybody's in the church up towards the sanctuary. So I sit 2 pews behind the last people. And I'm just sitting there and seeing what's going on. And they're singing songs and they're doing this and somebody's praying, somebody's doing that. And then the door opens to the left of the sanctuary, and in comes, you know, 3 or 4 people, and then this older guy, and who had a baby blue clergy shirt on. He looked like a hippie. Then he just plops himself down in front of the altar and halfway under the altar, and just sitting there while the prayer meeting is going on. And I come to find out his name was Father Jude Milley. The whole time I was sitting there, I felt 2 things. One is, I had never sang before. I told when I was in the first, second grade, don't sing, because I couldn't sing, because I was always been hard of hearing. And so I didn't, but I loved music. So that's why I spent all my time playing the piano and whatnot. But God put me between 2 people who sang so bad. But the thought came to mind, they're not bothered. They're not self-conscious. They're singing joy and praising the Lord. So what's keeping you from doing that? You know, nobody's going to pay attention to you anyway, especially with these people singing the way they do. You can sing maybe at least that bad or that good. That was one. The other great thought was, even before all of that, when I walked in and I heard everything going on, there was a sense of being at home. Immediately, you're home. You are found your home. So as it all unfolds after that, one thing leads to another where I decide, I get involved, I go to the Antioch weekend, which is the basic Christian weekend for students at the time, and then I become part of the whole team. But in the meantime, I decided, you know, I'm not going to be making the grades enough to become a physical therapist. I think maybe I want to do this. I want to be about this. I just can't imagine anything being greater than being about this. So I will go and study and become a priest. So I contacted Andre. I said, Andre, you'll never guess what I'm going to do. I've decided I'm going to go to seminary and study to be a priest. And Andre said, well, that's fine. He said, I'm never going to do that again. The irony was that by the time I had decided to join the Franciscans, he went back to the Franciscans. He said, you're never going to believe this. He said, I'm going back too. I said, really? I thought you were never going to do that again. He said, well, and he was ordained a deacon. God still had another path for him. He met this woman and he married her, but he still wanted to work for the church. And they proceeded to have 4 children. He was already 41 at the time. He became the stay-at-home dad. But he had a full-time job with the local parish. So I become a Franciscan. But I didn't join the order Father Jude Billy belonged to, I joined the TORs, which was interesting because the vocation director calls up the friary and Jude answers, "Don't you find it peculiar that here's this guy, he's living at the friary and he wants to become a Franciscan, but he's not applying to your order?" And I said, "What did you say? I'll tell him, Jude." And Father Jude said, "Well, no, I don't find that peculiar at all. I was attracted to the Franciscans through Father Michael Scanlon, who was the rector of St. Francis Seminary at the time. He came down and gave a talk at the Newman Center in Morgantown on penance, because he had just written a book on penance. And I talking to him about these, and he said, "Well, we're having a come and see weekend. Why don't you come up and, you know, talk about it?" So I did, but then he wasn't the rector. By the time I went there, he was not the rector anymore. He was the president of Franciscan University, which was then the College of Steubenville. As things would happen, I lived with Michael Scanlon and Dan Santisi. These are spiritual giants in the renewal. And I ended up living with them at Steubenville before we finished our theology. We had to go out a year. That was my assignment. I was the assistant director of the Christian Conference Office, running these charismatic conferences. My real spiritual, big spiritual awakening was through the friary, was through charismatic renewal. And I think the greatest thing it gave me was permission. Permission to be who I was and how I was in my faith.
How did your parents react to this whole change?
Oh, yeah. Well, let's go back to the friary then. Okay, in 1974, in March of 1974, I'm turning 24. I come home. My mother's mother is living with my mother in Charleston, and it's my 24th birthday, so we have my brothers and their families and friends are gathering around at their house. After they sang happy birthday, they said, "Blow out the candles." And I said, "Well, before I blow out the candles, I'd like to pray." Well, everybody stopped, like, okay, very awkward. So I prayed. I forget what I prayed. And then I blew out the candles. Well, that was key because Christmas of 1974, my father had come in to Charleston from Florida. Actually, he was living in Texas for a while. My mother and father, even though they were divorced, they were on very good terms. He was staying with my grandmother, mother, and me at Christmas at the house in Charleston. So I said, "Well, I have to leave, get back to Morgantown, because we have New Year's Eve is a Tuesday, and we're having a prayer meeting and mass to celebrate the new year. And so I have to get back up there." And the word had come out to me, said, "Jim, you'll never guess what, they got a piano." One of Jude's fellow colleagues had donated a piano to the friary. So everybody was excited because they knew I played the piano. I informed them I'm leaving, you know. My dad says, "You know, I'd like to come up with you." And now my relationship with my dad, and he loved us. There was no doubt about his love for us. But we were afraid of him. He could be very out of control. And so we were afraid of him. Now, even though I had been in the Air Force and all this, I was still afraid of him. And I just didn't want him to mess up what I had found. But I was afraid of him. So I didn't say, "No, I don't want you to go." So on our way up to the friary, I'm thinking this 2.5 hour, 3 hour drive, I said, "I'm going to have to tell him something. Because only God knows what my father might say." And he was never shy of saying what was on his mind. And God help anybody that he doesn't like or he has a problem with, because he's going to say something. I said, "Now, Dad, I have to tell you something." And I mean, here's how much the little boys that he kept us, you know, he was still Daddy. So I said, "Daddy, I got to tell you something. Now, here's what's going to happen. You know, there's this prayer meeting. It's kind of like I always think it's like campfire. You know, it's like we sit around a campfire and we sing songs and we share stories. We do things like that." I said, "You're going to see things and hear things that you might not quite understand." And I did my best to try to explain, you know, tongues and this, that, and the other. And so we get there. So we arrived just a half hour before. So we come into the kitchen. I introduce him to Father Jude. This is the priest. You know, this is the priest. And he doesn't have a black shirt on. He's got a baby blue cleric shirt on. And his hair, he looks like one of the hippies that I didn't want my sons to grow up to be. So I introduce them. And I said, Jude, can I talk to you a second? I'll be with you in a little bit, Dad. And I said, who's giving the introduction talk tonight to the Charismatic Renewal? He said, Jim, he's giving the talk. Well, he's younger than me. And I'm thinking, Jude, can you do it? Would you do it? I says, so my dad is going to have a problem no matter what. But I might have a chance if a priest is saying these things and not some college kid. So Jude says, okay, I'll do it. So now we're into prayer meeting. Now there's just a handful of people, the piano over on the one side, and we made a kind of a circle forming on either side of me, around behind me, down towards the outside of the sanctuary. So in comes Jude and them, and after this, and I'm playing the piano, so my back is to the circle. It came to a point, and the point was, does anybody want to share anything? And I froze when I heard my father's voice. He evidently stood up and he said, I want to say something. He said, I came up here to see what kind of people my son is associated with. And then he says, and I found Jesus. Crying. He said, I thought I knew Jesus. I thought I knew him, but I found him tonight like I've never found him before. I'm crying. And one of the girls from the Magnificat house who was there, Mary Kay or Joanne, turns to Mary Kay and says, oh, Mary Kay, look how touched Jim is by that man's witness. She says, it's his father. Long story short on that one, that night, we're celebrating New Year's. But the next morning, I already have an appointment to make a retreat at the Paulus House of Studies in D.C. So here's my father. And I already told him, I said, you know, I don't know, I've got to go to Washington, D.C. I'm going to go to a retreat before on the way. And he said, oh, it's all right, I'll get back. A little background on that is my father, it was so significant to my father, the experience, that he sold cookware. And he was pretty much buddy-buddy with the higher-ups in his cookware. That's why he was in Dallas, Texas, and not in Fort Myers, Florida, where he really lived. And he was separated from his fourth wife, who was younger than his youngest son, me. As things unfolded, he went back to Dallas. He attended one of the largest prayer meetings in the country that was taking place at Dallas-Fort Worth. So he informs me he's going to go back to Fort Myers, but he's never, ever going to work for this company again. He's never going to sell cookware again. He did it all his life. I said, why? He said, because they're a bunch of crooks, and Jesus doesn't want me to work for a bunch of crooks. So he went back to Fort Myers with the hope maybe of reconciling with that. The job he took was to become the janitor at the local Catholic church, which he did until he couldn't do it anymore. And all I can think of, Father Ed Hoffler saying, well, maybe you're going to be the one. And I always thought, if you're going to be the one, then you have to be such a shining example that everybody's going to say, oh, I want what you have. But that wasn't what it was. It was, you are where you are. Other people are going to come because you're connected to them or they're connected to you. And then what happens, happens. Not because you're such a great shining example of anything. In fact, it's going to happen sometimes when you don't want it to happen. You know, if it were up to you, he wouldn't have been there. You could have breathed a sigh of relief if he'd have said, no, I won't go. As the years have unfolded, I'm more and more, you know, what God has done for me and my vocation, given me the privilege of being a part of people's spiritual journeys and their spiritual growth. You know, I certainly have made many mistakes and fallen and over again. I still wouldn't want to be anywhere else as far as what I'm doing and who I am and what I'm able to be a part of. It's more about being a part of other people. And my vocation, as I would say to people, is like The only thing that gave me the courage, not the only thing, but one of the key things that gave me the courage to even study to be a priest, especially after I knew I was not fit to be one, was the fact that I became a part of a community at college, at WVU, at the Friary, where they all knew they were priests. They all knew they were priestly people. I was just a part of a priestly people. So I can be a priest. Because it's not just me being the priest. I'm a priest among priestly people.
Priestly people.
And that's the big thing of my vocation.
Now, did you stay a Franciscan, or did you...
I came to be a diocesan
priest, didn't you?
I was ordained in Loretto, Pennsylvania in 1982. My first 2 years assignment was to be a associate pastor in Pittsburgh, because we had a parish, one of the Franciscan parishes. From that assignment, I was to become the associate master of professed of our Franciscan students who took simple vows, but not final vows. So I was the associate master of professed and a master of professed. To go back to Toronto, Canada, where I eventually got my degree from before, where I got my master's degree, to go back there and become the associate master of professed. Well, I had an opportunity before I'd move up there of 1984, of June, to come and see my mother before I was to go to Canada again. And I was ill, but I was determined. So I came. While I was in Charleston with my mother, I fell ill to where I had to have surgery. So I had the surgery. The surgery went fine, but you couldn't travel for 3 weeks. So the whole time I was with my mother, something told me, you know, I don't want to leave. Not my mother, but I want to be in West Virginia. It's home. I want to be. So I went and talked to Father Jody DeBias, who was a pastor at Blessed Sacrament of South Charleston, about, you know, what do you think? He said, well, go talk to Father Bill Petro, who was a Franciscan, but had just a year before become a priest of the diocese as a Capuchin. So I went and talked to Bill. So then Jody set up an appointment, a 5-minute appointment with Bishop Hodges, because he was down doing a confirmation. From that conversation, Bishop Hodges said, well, you know, I can't request from your provincial that you come to the diocese. You have to. So I call up the provincial, who was a new provincial, and told him what I was going on. He said, well, go talk to Father Jordan. So I go talk to a priest who's giving a retreat, and I said, first off, I know you're not going to agree with me, what I'm about to tell you. And his first response was, oh, Jim, I'm always in agreement with my brother. So I tell him the whole story, and he looks at me and he says, well, I said, what do you think? I think you have to do it. You're not going to talk me out? He said, no, I think you have to do it. He says, it's the only way you're going to know. And I didn't leave the Franciscans because I didn't like the Franciscans. I just had this real calling to be a priest in West Virginia. My first assignment was to be the Catholic chaplain at Marshall University, run the Newman Center at Marshall University. The irony of ironies, that's what I was designated to be before I was ordained. And then what happens? I ended up being the campus minister at Marshall University for 6 years. Right straight with crooked lines. That's my favorite saying, God right straight with crooked lines. But it's all, you know, about my vision. And my vision even now, and I look back at 1973 when I was introduced to Charismatic Renewal, and I think how everything that I came to realize is still true, but I realize it's so bigger than I ever thought it was. It's so much more encompassing than I ever thought it was. The one word I didn't say when I decided to take the step to study and become a seminarian, study to be a priest. The reason that I was able to do that was I had the thought that Jesus talking to me and saying, now that you know this truth of the charismatic truth and who you are, your excuse was always that you weren't good enough. But now you know that doesn't matter. Now you know that has nothing to do about your worthiness. Or you being good enough. It's about me. You don't have to worry about that. I'm good enough.
What is your favorite part of being a priest?
My favorite part is being able to be with people at these key, crucial moments of their life. They need to know that God is with them and that their lives are so much more than perhaps they realize, and that grace is so much more than they ever thought it was. And I'm saying these key moments from birth to marriage to death. I seem to be known for, if you need a spiritual person, a priest, in your crucial moments of death and dying, dealing with grief, dealing with the loss, then here he is. This is what he is best at. He will be with you, and he will help you just by being with you and giving you assurance and comfort, and at the same time, allowing you to feel the loss with hope that he has, that he knows. And so I became known for that. And I never would have set out to be a priest if I thought that was what was going to be.
Your whole life has been like layered with steps heading to heaven.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, that's a good way of putting it. I had a trio. We called ourselves Rejoicing in the Spirit. And it was a husband and wife. She played the guitar. He played stand-up bass. And I played the keyboard. And we all sang. And we traveled up and down from Maine to Florida to 80, we lost count, 80 parishes over a two-year period of time. I told them one time, the couple, I said, you know, I just had this feeling that really called to ministry to the elderly, to a geriatric ministry. I just feel like one day, you know, that's going to happen, that it's really something. And I jokingly said, I just hope I'm not one of them when I get around to doing it. For the last 6 years, I've been going every Wednesday, and I'll be there tomorrow, to the local nursing home in Grafton called Rosewood. I share an hour with the residents, and usually a 20, 25 people come into their dining room in their wheelchairs. And we do nothing for an hour but sing good gospel songs. It's that prophecy almost. It's like the prophetic message is now real. It's like, you're doing it. You're doing that. You didn't want to have to be this old to do it, but you know, 67 is not bad.
Player. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what kind of vocational advice would you give to someone who came to you like you came to a priest and said, I think I want to become a priest?
I think it has a lot to do with their age. To me, it has a lot to do with their spirituality. My concern would be for somebody who is religious, but their religion is primarily focused on the things they do at church, praying these prayers and praying those prayers. That my concern would be that you can do all of that, because I did all of that, and not have this spiritual really sense of deep spiritual connection. But there has to be that conversion. I'd first want to talk to them about their conversion. Talk to them about their spiritual life. How do they relate to God? You know, do they relate to God? But they need to have that relationship with Jesus Christ. That's got to be first. First thing you need to do, and I had to. First thing I did when I thought about it, got a spiritual director. I got a spiritual director, and I've always had one since. So you need to get somebody that you go to so you can talk about your spiritual life. They found me be that person. I'd be, you know, we'll sit down and we'll just talk about your life. It isn't just about, here, you go and be a priest, and you can go do this, you can go do this, and go. No, it's about your life.
Recommend the same thing to someone who wasn't sure if they wanted to go into the religious life, like maybe they want to get married, or did they want to remain single?
Talk about religious life. You're only going to know if you go do it. You know, you get to a point of saying, I feel I have to at least try this, or I have to at least go, and this, and it will be revealed whether this is the path that I'm supposed to be on. You know, and the worst thing that happens, you find out it isn't your path, but you go do another path. As far as religious life goes, you certainly, if you're thinking about becoming a religious or a priest, then you need to explore that first. If you're in college or above, then there's time that you could go explore that. You can't give yourself if you don't know who you are. And we need to have priests and religious who have a sense of who they are. That experience of renewal for me was not about, oh, this is all I want to do, so I'm going to go become a priest. No, this is one way or the other, I have to be about this, whether it's being a priest or not. I have to be fully given to this because this, I finally found the pearl of great price. And by darn, I'm not going to let it go, whatever that leads me to. So maybe it's not to be a priest or a religious, but you have this great spiritual sense, this sense of calling. Maybe it's to be a great mother, a great father, a great single person who leads other people and is involved in ways that, you know, our church needs people in all walks of life who are committed, caught by the Spirit.
Would you like to give our listeners a blessing, Father?
My Father Francis of Assisi always gave the blessing that is a paraphrase of Deuteronomy. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May he turn his countenance to you. May he show his face to you and give you peace. And the Lord bless you, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Amen.
And thank you again, Father Jim, for being here and sharing your call with our listeners and for all the good works that you do. I'm Irene Carubia, host for Answering the Call, wishing all a blessed day.
Answering the Call is produced by Light of Life Radio, your listener-supported Catholic radio station in North Central West Virginia and the Upper Ohio Valley. Archived recordings of Answering the Call are available at www.lolradio.org.